You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. Tony Duchesne here, and welcome to Drinks with Tony. The holidays are coming up, but hey, this ain't no holiday. It always turns out this way. Here I am, and I haven't even written my screenplay yet this year. So I'm going to take the 10-day screenplay outline workshop with Tony Duchesne. That's right, December 22nd through January 2nd. Go to drinkswithtony.com. We'll have a registration link there. It's a daily workshop. We are going to pound through and create a massive, amazing screenplay. Your screenplay, our work with you, one on two, on three, on four. But we really get through it. You commit to about an hour to 3 hours per day, depending on the assignment and where we're at in the process. So go to drinkswithtony.com to register. That's the 10-day screenplay outline workshop. End 2025 with a solid goal to have your screenplay absolutely done at the beginning of 2026. What happens then? Well, then you find a director. Speaking of writer-directors, on the show today we have Rob Grant. And as you'll hear, I kind of gush a lot. I almost feel like Theo Vaughn when I interviewed him. But what happened was, and I talk about it a bit in this segment, that I was just pitched, usually when I'm pitched film directors and writers, I just immediately turned down. But this one turned on because it's a coming-of-age Mormon story, you know, set in the 80s. And I went, what? A coming-of-age Mormon story set in the 80s? That's crazy. Because I wrote a coming-of-age Jehovah's Witness story set in the 80s, and it came out on film and was directed by Eric Stoltz. And it's called Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk. But someone else did something almost the same, but in the Mormon religion? Oh my God, let me watch the first 20 minutes just to make sure it's not insane before I commit. So I watched the first 20 minutes thinking I'm just going to watch the first 20 minutes and go, okay, cool, yeah, this is good. Everyone's looking all right, and I'll get them on the show. I couldn't stop watching it. I had to finish the film. It totally pulled me in. It's to the point where I'm like so excited that a film like this is coming out. A coming of age story is coming out in 2025 that just truly not only grabs the essence of the 80s, but really feels like that authenticity there. It's just, it's profound, and I understand how hard it is to get, because I worked with Eric Stoltz, and we worked together and with a ton of other people to try to get the aesthetic true, to get something authentic, as well as a story that's totally compelling. And I understand how hard it is to get that done, and it takes years. And I was just like, oh man, I got to interview Rob Grant. Ladies and gentlemen, Rob Grant.
Hi, I'm Rob Grant, writer-director of the movie This Too Shall Pass, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show, yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Rob Grant. He's the director and writer of the film This Too Shall Pass. Rob, how are you?
I'm very good. How about you?
I'm well. You're backlit quite well. You got something there.
Yeah. It's the roof light. It's just in a wonderful spot, luckily.
Yeah, so to our listeners, are you in a movie theater or a screening room?
This is my personal screening room, actually. Yeah, this is the self-built.
Really? Oh my God. Can I come hang with you?
Next time you're in Vancouver.
You're in Vancouver. Okay. Because with the film, I saw it was shot in, was it in Calgary? No, wait. I got that wrong.
Yeah, it was shot in Calgary.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I'll start with the film because I got to say, I adored it. And
Oh, thank you.
you got the, how did you get the 1980s vibe transported to 2025 so well? It blew my mind. I don't think I've seen anyone do that other than Eric Stoltz on the film I wrote. But it was great.
That was a serious deep dive on our part of research. I mean, I was very careful about just hitting the nostalgia button for the sake of nostalgia. My recollection of the late 80s, early 90s was more grungier than what I'd say Stranger Things shows,
Yeah.
with the glossy kind of look. My memory is tobacco soaked and carpets and wood paneled walls, and that everything was kind of turning to shit, or sorry, to crap as we were going into the grunge era. So I kind of just used that as my go-to reference and went headlong into A, not making sure that things felt too clean and too pretty, and B, it was more of getting into the heads of the teenagers in the film, thinking that their life's not going so great, so I've made sure that the world around them didn't look and feel so great as well.
And yeah, and great job, because it's the because I did a I worked on a film that was also set in the 80s, and it was also and it was based on me growing up a Jehovah's Witness, which your character is growing up Mormon. So when your publicist reached out, I was like, oh my God, please tell Rob I need to talk to him. This isn't even an ask. This is like a very important moment in my life. But I don't know where I was going. But oh, when wardrobe department started giving me sketches of what they were gonna do with the kids in the film, I was like, oh no, they were all wearing like they were trying to look like Back to the Future and the pulled up polo shirts. I'm like, no, you don't understand. Muted. It's just keep it muted, because it's everyone wasn't a cartoon character. It's just everyone was just trying to get through life. And then the sigh of relief from our wardrobe ladies was like, oh, thank you.
I bet. No, that was the same with us. We kind of just had a rule of like avoid neon, avoid breaker, and that kind of translated from that look all the way across the soundtrack. Because like, don't try and not do synth. Try to stick with, the rocky grunge stuff that we had at that time too. So that's kind of, it kind of just all of that original planning bled across all of the departments for us.
Oh, that's beautiful. You got some great music in there. Oh my God, The Cure. I was Jesus and Mary Chain in there too?
Oh yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
I was going, oh my God, like nailing the soundtrack. And yes, you kept the synthesizers out. I just realized that. I watched the film yesterday, and what you could have done was cartoon it up, but you didn't. You kept, and the music also helped. You must have had a great music supervisor, by the way.
We did Natasha Dupree out of Vancouver here. She's amazing, and I think she got the vibe with us right away. She did say right off the bat when she read the script, she was like, "There's no way you can afford this soundtrack, so we're just going to have to ask for a lot of friends and family discounts and favors." And luckily, her tactic of going after Robert Smith and The Cure first, and having them set what we believe was a fair price, set the barometers for that. All the other kind of bands kind of had to be like, "Well, if Robert Smith gave that price, I guess we'll do the same." And that kind of, so shout out to The Cure and Robert Smith for kind of setting the tone for what we needed as a favor to get the movie across the finish line.
Did Robert Smith when did like did he have to like look at the script or see anything, or was it because
I believe I don't know the ins and outs of it. I just know Natasha got us the music soup, got the deal from them. I believe we had to show them the script just to make sure there was nothing crazy in there. We had to do that with like even like we had used the NHL logos and stuff, so the NHL had to review the script and stuff too. So yeah, we made sure that everyone kind of had to sign off on it, not knowing what they were getting into. So.
Oh, that's really cool. That's right. Yeah, because I'm trying to be a hockey fan right now, and I know nothing about hockey, but baseball season's over, and a lot of my friends are hockey fans. So I'm like, okay, how do I learn about this? And like, just the
I
rules.
mean, it's yeah the what's it called, the Four Nations Four Nations tournament that happened last February was kind of like a I think that was a good barometer for how crazy hockey can be for a bunch of people. It seemed like, yeah, between Canada, US, the, you know, Finland and Sweden, I think were the four. That's just like that brought it to a whole new level. So I think there's more fans now. Now's a good time.
It's and the other beautiful thing is I'm from San Francisco, so the baseball thing in the United States, it's when it comes to San Francisco and Los Angeles. I live in Los Angeles now, which is enemy territory. So
I bet.
it's so at the same time, I'm like, oh wait, if I choose a hockey team right now, I could be a LA fan, and no one would get mad at me. Well, they'd get some people get mad at me, but I don't like San Jose. I didn't grow up in San Jose. I was up near San Francisco, so that doesn't even mean anything to me. And some friends get mad about that.
LA's Kings are on the way up, man. They're gonna be good. They're gonna be good.
They're going to be good, but what's their story? Is because like with the San Francisco Giants, they were a working class kind of baseball club. Like my grandparents used to work the stands at when before they built Candlestick Park, so that's how deep it goes with me. So there's like there's always kind of a team story, and as storytellers, I'm always looking for the story, and I'm like, you know what? I might have to get online with like the coolest story team just as a bandwagon awful fan, because people will be like, you didn't start liking this until 2025, and I'll be like, no. And by the way, I'm gonna die like a lot sooner than you, so I'm not even gonna be in this game as long as you
Check
kids.
out. Take a deep dive on their Stanley Cup run, and I think it was like 2010, 2011, somewhere around there. They were not meant to be a contender at all. In fact, they went up against Vancouver Canucks in the first round. That was a major favorite, and they just beat the crap out of them. Went on to win the Stanley Cup in like 14. They won 14 out of 16 games, something crazy like that with Quick, Doughty. Like they, and then they nearly became a dynasty. They won two or three in the next 4 years. Like they were a working class team. They're good. Drew Doughty's a really, really good defenseman. Canadian kid too.
Okay, but that helps me a lot, because not to be totally vain and stupid, but I'm a little vain and stupid. I love their jerseys. Just the
Oh yeah,
black,
no, they're
like
great.
that's goth, man. That's like your character. That's kind of I don't want to give away any plot points, but he's the cool looking guy with the almost
The
cure
Robert Smith
hair.
fan.
Yeah, I'm looking at the LA Kings, and I'm looking at his style, and I'm thinking, yep, that's what I want to wear.
Well, the Kings took it from the Raiders, I think. They took
Oh,
the
did
color
they?
scheme from. Yeah.
Huh, interesting. And then the
Yeah, the
Raiders,
golden
I don't even
white front.
understand Raiders fans, because the Raiders moved to Southern California, then they moved to Las Vegas. At what point do you just go, you know what, you're not in my city anymore? It's just.
I think you just die with the logo. That's it.
Yeah.
Like I'm a big Las Vegas fan. I have a Raiders hat. It's just because they're in Vegas now. I'll probably have to do the same when Oakland gets the ballpark down there too.
Well, at the same time, I'm a little more open with the A's in LA, because they didn't get treated right at all in Oakland. And when I grew up, like I knew the Giants because I lived on the peninsula. I didn't know Oakland. Like Oakland was like across the bridge. That you can't get there. But you can get bleacher seats at like Candlestick Park. And also when I'm in junior high, they're like, if you get good grades, we'll take you to a Giants game. So it's so infi I didn't even know what Oakland was until I was about 13 with the with baseball wise. So I might really get into the Las Vegas A's if they treat them right.
Absolutely. And is Billy Beane still their manager? That's the big question.
Right. I don't know if he's still involved. Did you see Moneyball?
Of course. Yeah, of
Isn't that
course.
the one of the best for me is one of my favorite baseball movies.
I mean, yeah, well, sports movies in general. I don't know how you make a movie about baseball statistics an exciting story is. And I showed that to my wife. Like when they go on the 20-game run, she's like, "You can't write this." I was like, "Absolutely not." If
Yeah.
you wrote it, it was bull, not true.
When truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
What are did you grow up Mormon?
No, so what I'll give you the backstory there was
Yes.
my looking for something to write because it was mid-COVID. Everything was bubbled up. Couldn't figure out how to shoot anything. So I was just like to my agent, I was like, you know what? Find me something to write. And then he's like, I think I got a guy named Michael Baker who grew up Mormon, had this crazy rebellious weekend away from the church that he kind of wants to turn into a story. And I'm like, I don't know if you saw my last movie, Harpoon. It's three people stuck in a boat talking about trying to eat each other. I don't know if I'm the right person for this. And then he's like, no. He's like, he's looking for some bite to it. So the more we started talking, the more I kind of found a connection between my growing up and being in a Roman Catholic household, going to Catholic elementary school, all my Catholic guilt, and then going to a public high school and having this kind of explosion of exploring who I was. So I started to find things in there. Started to also realize that my high school years, or at least to a teenager, can kind of feel like a horror movie when it comes to your social life, to your dating life, all these other things. And so I was like, well, if I attack it from those angles, maybe I have a shot. And then just conversations about, not wanting to leave anything on the table, regrets. We were in a bubble. I didn't know what the future was going to look like. And I'm like, I got to stop being scared. I always wanted to do my version of A Dazed and Confused or Stand By Me. And so I kind of just took a jump in saying, I don't know if I'm the right fit for this, but I think I've got an angle about a teenager who wants his life to be like those coming of age movies, and it's not working out. And as soon as I found that kind of crux of using my own history, it opened the story up for me, and we just started going back and forth about his philosophies with the church and his interactions with the church and mine with the Catholic Church, and just it kind of blossomed from there, and it became a really cathartic writing experience for me.
And it's universal themes. I think especially when people tackle, stuff like Mormonism or other extreme religions. Even though I grew up Jehovah's Witness, so and the film that I got to be a part of was essentially my story. But the themes are universal. And it's just to like present them to the public and go, hey, this is really wacky. Let me inform you a little bit, but at the same time, it's everybody. We all feel insane
Yeah,
inside.
exactly. And I was very cautious about not making it a hit piece on the LDS Church, because the point was that these restrictions are kind of, universal, whether it could just be strict parents. Like I had a friend, a lot of those interactions with the, taking the door off the bedroom were from a friend whose family was not religious at all. It's just like very strict. So I just like all these pieces started to fit together, and it kind of just became more of a story about self-discovery than per se an attack on any specific religion. So,
I love that because
and that's
even
again the point of a coming of age story.
yes, when I wrote my novel based on my life, and then when I got to adapt the film, even with our director, he was saying, I mean, we were both like on point. No, nothing hits the Jehovah's Witnesses. They're not the butt of the joke. The butt of the every single laugh we get has to be the family and the problem with the character. We have no. There's no comment on that. There's comment on our
Yeah.
character going through his struggle. And I think that's the way to attack all of these types of stories is don't be preachy, just show the pain.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that was definitely something we were very cognizant of the whole time, as we were making it. It's like, let's not make sure that this is they're being the butt of the joke,
Yeah.
which is a pretty important element, because it also opens it up. If you make it such a strict attack on the religion, it's like, well, that's just this, it's a Mormon movie. No one else really needs to see it because they're not involved with that. So it was more important to make sure that it kind of felt universal to anybody that's been a teenager.
And as we're talking about it, I just realize what a great job you did with your protagonist and people just reacting to, wait, you're Mormon? And that reaction, I understand that reaction when people found out I was Jehovah's Witness as a kid. I'm no longer anymore, in case there's anyone going, wait a second. But it's just like you just feel weird. But I found out even after like high school, no one thought I was weird. They just thought I was, oh yeah, you were just a Jehovah's Witness guy and we didn't quite understand it, but you were cool. And I'm like, oh, I wish everyone would have told me that and gave me a hug when I was in high school.
Exactly. I guess, you feel like an outsider. And like through my conversations with Michael Baker, who, is Simon in the movie, He gave me some like really good insights. And like, yeah, you have different masks that you kind of have to wear depending on where you are. There's the at-home mask, there's around the family, there's the around the church mask, then
Yes.
there's the around your friends mask, and they're all different. And he's like, that compartmentalizing kind of is what allowed him to skate in these different ecosystems. And I think again, that's something that a lot of people, especially in discovering who you are as a teenager, is something that you can kind of recognize that we all had to do until we figured out, oh no, this is the one that fits.
Yeah, and it's okay that it fits, which I mean, I was, again, I'll tell you, I adored the film because I just feel like you not only did it right on that level, but you did it right on just on a film level, especially pointing out that the John Hughes references throughout the film was it was fantastic, because I'm like, oh my God, this you made a John Fields film you John Hughes movie of 2025 as far as I'm concerned, and did it
Thank you.
without we just I feel like we get too much just pushing a point across in like most movies these days, and your film doesn't push a point across, it just shows.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean that I like, and that's to say that kind of comes in the editing, because the script and the first edit was much longer, and it had a lot more just like straightforwardness to it. And like as you get into the editing process, you start peeling back and realizing that it's better, some stuff is better left unsaid, some stuff's better, the subtext, the John Hughes one. Like when I was writing, I just was like, I can't believe that a person, the first generation that grew up with televisions and movies, wouldn't be able to recognize situations where they're trying to live out these movie fantasies. What's the detriment to that? I did a documentary that kind of touches on how movie violence can affect the real life. So like for me, it's always paramount of mind. I feel like more people now, especially, to talk about and reference their lives in accordance with movies and how dangerous that can be. And so to kind of ignore that and I pretend that that didn't doesn't exist felt it just felt like it needed to be done. And I also I just for the long it's just the weirdest thing with this movie, where at first I was so against the idea of writing this, just because I didn't think I was the right fit, until all these pieces of all these different ideas of things that I'd always wanted to touch upon kind of funneled into the perfect narrative for me, that it just, sometimes it just, the universe provides.
I think the universe provides when we open ourselves up to it and do the hard work, which is essentially just going, how do I put this puzzle piece together? And you get your notepad out and you start writing without knowing how the hell it's going to be pulled off. And then that's the beautiful part, where it's just like, that's when the opening of creativity and being like nerve-wracked and going, this isn't going to work, but you put pen to paper and go, still not going to work, but you keep showing up feeling that awfulness until something hits.
I'm certainly a glutton for punishment. I'm known for focusing on the negative side outcomes before the positives. And so it was, yeah, in the middle of writing this original script was a lot more dire and negative at first, a lot harder. And it was just like right in the heat of the pandemic, I was dealing with a father dying of cancer, and I just it was that was when like the optimism of youth kind of triggered that aspect of the story to me, that there's like you can still have eternal optimism within a chaotic situation. And that freed me up to have a lot more enjoyable, heartfelt time with the story rather than just being my usual cynical self. And it felt like the story and the world and me at the time just kind of needed that. So.
Yeah, needed it in a big way. And I just yeah it's I just watched it yesterday, so I apologize to everyone that I'm gushing so much. I try not to gush, but it's a good movie. This too shall pass, which I thought was about a kidney stone.
But more bowel movement, any of the above.
No, what a great title too. It's, I mean, because it's biblical and it's the theme.
I mean, there, yeah, I we, that one, I'm terrible with titles. Like, that's always been my weak point, and that kind of one is the one that kind of stuck. I had tried for a little while trying with rose-tinted glasses, but everyone was like, no, that's too on the nose. But But
What okay, so rose tinted glasses. What else was in the what was in play?
those were the two big ones. I didn't really
Okay.
have many other. Like as soon as This Too Shall Pass came in, that was it. Kind of that one kind of just never left the front
Yeah, because rose tinted
page.
glasses does, yeah, it's that I agree. I agree with your advisors and yourself going, eh, this too shall pass is a better angle.
You never know if it sticks until it releases, so we'll find out, I guess.
Isn't it crazy? And that's the thing about I'm always thinking about this way too much is the process and the outcome. I don't know how you deal with it. I've dealt with it wrong like so many times. Yeah.
Not
It's where I hope the next time I get my next outcome, which it is hopefully a book that's sitting on a two agents' desks right now. But if I get a good outcome of that, I'm so excited to redo how I reacted to my good outcomes before, because now I have the experience that I need to have a process going on the next thing. So I wake up to that while I do things like interviews or Q&A or anything like that. It's like that's beautiful and amazing, and the applause is fantastic, but I better be in the trenches the next morning working on the next thing, or my brain's going to be inflated and I might be a prick.
My friend always has a good line that he stole from Andy Warhol. It's when make art, and then when people are talking about that art, make more art.
Yeah.
Easier
And
said
that,
than done, though.
yeah, but I've only been through this process once where I got to completely do it with the director from beginning to end, and he was so gracious to have me through the whole thing. And it was like war. I mean, it's not like this happy little puffy cloud with a bunch of unicorns and everything going well. It's like I'm actually getting into arguments with him. People are arguing with me. There's people that I'll never speak to again who are on crew, and I'm just going, oh my God, you're like a bad person. And then there's people who I'm like friends for the rest of my life, because it's such an intense intimacy. And I mean, is it the same for you when you're working on a film? Because I know you've done a lot. So is it kind of come to that?
It's always the same. Day one, you're just getting through the jitters, and then after that, it's like, it's not the glitz and glam that everyone thinks it is. I can say that. It's really hard. It's really trying. It's terrible on your mental. It's terrible on your physical. And just when you think you've done something that you're proud of, then it goes to the public, and you get kicked in the teeth all over again. So it's like it's just one, like I said, glutton for punishment, I guess.
Yeah. But in the end, what's more fun, the process or the outcome?
I love my favorite time is the editing.
Yeah.
It's when the most possibilities can happen with what you have. It's a bit more of a challenging puzzle piece. I'd say right now, just in the pre-release stuff, I'm probably at my scariest part where it's like I want to just turn off the internet, close the doors, turn off the lights, and bury my head in the sand for a couple months. But it's
Yeah.
all part of the process.
Yeah. And you have to pretend like, and the other thing is, which, because you got to pretend like this just happened for you, but people don't understand how long it takes to get a movie done from idea to what you have coming up, which is, I'm going to make you even more nervous, which is next week.
Exactly. So, yeah,
But
notes.
that's the culmination of probably 5 to 7 years, usually, if not longer.
Absolutely. So yeah, I think yeah, there's like it's a two-part. It's like you kind of get to the point where you're like, please just get it out there so I can free up some brain space to the next thing.
Yeah.
But two, it's like your next thing, especially in movies, is kind of reliant on the success of the previous one. So it can be it's this weird dichotomy of not wanting to pay attention to the noise, but kind of needing to be a part of it. It's weird. It's tough.
Yeah. Well, I feel like you got a good. I feel like there's a train coming in. I didn't know. I haven't watched your other movies, but you did a documentary on violence in movies. Is that what you said
It's
a few
called
minutes?
Fake Blood. Yeah, it's so I grew up in the genre world. Like my first movie was a really cheesy, like 16mm George Romero zombie style movie that did well enough that we got a chance to do another movie called Mon Ami. And it was from that one that was kind of like my dark version of a Fargo. But someone gets chopped up in the movie, like dismembered pretty severely. And then we got a fan video afterwards of someone walking through a hardware store telling us what tools they would use to chop up a corpse. And I remember being very disturbed by someone sending us that video, being like, is this a gag? Is this serious? Like, what is our responsibility in this person's current state? And so we did use that that fan video as a kickoff to make a documentary called Fake Blood, that's kind of our responsibility in horror, and kind of take a deep dive into some pretty famous cases and stuff like that. So that one's a weird one, but yeah, it's like it just my whole world, like coming up in the genre world has always been tumultuous, in that I'll make a genre movie, but it's got very heavy influences from people that I grew up watching, like John Cassavetes, you know, David Lean, like all these other like more talking movies. And so even on the genre festivals and stuff, they've always been like, oh, it's not quite horror. You got a lot more dramatic stuff in here. So it kind of felt like a natural progression to just like, well, let's just try the straight drama one this time. So it'll be interesting to see how the old people that know my work from previous and movies kind of reacts to a different shift. I feel like a band that's suddenly made, like Coldplay suddenly making a rap album or something like that.
But yeah, I think at the same time we should disappoint some of our fans, because if they cling to it's if they cling to the idea of what we were, and I was even writing about this yesterday, and I think I wrote about it because of that was when I watched the first 20 minutes of your film, and then all of a sudden I had this like, I gotta write this thing down, because the realization of my first novel coming out 15 years ago, and how I want to shake that dude, and how I would do it so different now, because that's not me now, but it was me then. And so it's almost like I got to pay tribute to it, but I really hope that my next novel really disappoints the people of them, because that's because I would disappoint myself 15 years ago.
I'm the same way. It's like even like 3 years removed, I'm always like I would do things completely different. It's Life moves pretty fast.
Yeah, and if you don't take your time to look around, you might do
Might
that
miss
thing. Might miss
it.
it. Oh man, what a tribute to John Hughes. It's I mean, John Hughes, like it's like especially like Ferris Bueller's Day Off was, I mean, that was, I remember seeing that at the theater and having a life shift, 'cause it's just like I didn't understand it on so many levels, because I was just a, you know, my parents were in poverty as Jehovah's Witnesses. So him having his own room was just a fast, that was like, first off, that was like, wow, what a fantasy to have your own room, a door you can close, because how I grew up was in a very small apartment, and I like slept near the kitchen. So that my whole teenage years was just like people walking by. I was the hallway. So
No privacy.
right. So just that part, just, and also like, you know, he wasn't a Jehovah's Witness. So from that point of view, I'm sitting there going, well, that's what they do over there, but you know, we got the truth. And so I had faith at the time, and I was just like, well, it's fun to see what could be if I didn't know that, you know, God was going to kill me at any second if I was that. And
I live vicariously.
yes. But that's what we do with all films, I think, is we as audience, as fans, we live vicariously through the characters.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that like, and that's the thing. There's a bunch of conversations in the movie where the lead's wrestling with that. It's like, this isn't supposed to be my life. It's what this is. What if my life could be like? It's as soon as I got that linchpin of trying to find the op what the optimism of youth was, and had try to make this unbearably innocent and optimistic person and then have them real life try and break them, that kind of made everything a little easier for me. Because we all know that one person that just wants their life to be like the movies. I'm guilty of it. And then real life, like I said, just likes to kick you in the teeth sometimes. And it's about, you know, how you react to those changes.
And that creates character. Conflict creates character. I'm always telling my students that. You know what you do? Like, you got to just throw it on when you're writing a screenplay. It's got to be like 100 times worse, and everyone's still going to be along for the ride because we all understand that we create our own character by showing how we deal with conflict. Yet we don't have to deal with the same conflict within 90 minutes of what we put our poor protagonist through.
No, the goal was to just keep stacking more and more things on poor Simon as the movie went along. And the funny thing is, like, I'd say like a good 90% of those situations are based on real situations that either me or producer Michael Baker went through. Like, the without giving away too many spoilers, the getting arrested in the police station and having your mugshot taken and your pants fall down, that happened to me and my friends when we got taken in at 15.
That
That's a
was
real
real.
situation.
Actually, that's in a that was an adorable scene. I mean, I hate to use the word adorable. I feel like I've just feminized the whole movie, and we're two dudes here. You know, it
It's
comes
all
from a
good.
masculine point of view. Feminists should see it too. But I'm sorry,
Absolutely.
man. But go see this movie and don't listen to me because I got a weird thinking. But I really enjoyed that scene because that scene was a redemption scene of sorts. Because it was an adult redeeming a character, and I think he just needed one adult to go.
To acknowledge him.
Yeah,
No,
exactly.
and that's unfortunately the real life situation didn't happen that way. The police officer remained a total jerk the entire duration, including when my mom came to pick me up at 5 a.m. at the police station.
Yeah.
But
So what were you at the police station for? Was it the same thing?
it was mine was for vandalism, arson, and criminal mischief is what they tried to tag us with.
Yeah.
But what actually happened was we were snowboarders at the time, and we were making a snowboard video, and we were walking down to the park, a gravel park, to write our names in gas and light it for the intros of each of our scenes in the movie. But we took a light bulb, a glow, like a pot light, off of a front of a house. My buddy just grabbed it off, and then all of a sudden four police cars swarmed us, guns drawn, and pinned us to the ground, threw us in the back cop cars. And what happened was that that house turned out to be a police officer who had just testified in a really high-end gangland case, and the gang member said, "I know where you live," and so the house was under surveillance, and they thought we were
Wow.
sent by the gang to send a message by stealing their pot light. But then, of course, they take us down, and we've got a tank of gasoline on us. It's like, fair enough. So, unfortunate set of circumstances, that one.
At the same time, I feel like kids really need to be stupid when they're young. It helps because I think we have to get the stupidity out of us ourselves. And I've seen people who were really wrapped up tight when they were young not
Yeah,
get the
and it comes out
stupidity out.
later.
Yeah. And then when it comes out in your 40s, it's just like, oh, dude, oh,
Yeah.
no. You should have
Yeah,
done that as a
get it
kid.
out in the teen. That's what the teenage years are for.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I see kids like just horsing around and doing crazy stuff. And I'm like, good on you. Good on you. Go kick a car. Good. You need to do that
Yeah.
right now. It's,
Just
and
as long
it's
as there's
a,
no bodily harm. Yeah.
there's no what?
Bodily harm.
Right, exactly. And sometimes we do get hurt. And and when you're doing stuff, and that's where you like figure out the line. And I think that's what I guess kids are trying to figure out the line and cross the line until they pull back. And we're doing the same thing as writers. When you had to do your edit, you probably had to write all of those dark scenes, and even in the edit room, probably had to shoot all of that stuff in order to get the essence out. It's almost like you have to put that stuff in there.
Especially with, like, when you got seven teenagers on camera. And that was another big thing, is like we were adamant that we weren't going to cast 26-year-olds as teenagers. We went and found actual teenagers. But having seven of them in a room, you kind of have to let them go for a while, because trying to rein all that stuff in, I just knew it would be like, it would be a bad idea. It's like, let just shoot, just shoot, just shoot. Let's get as much as we can. Find it later. So we did, we very much did that. And it's like, going back to just the teenage years, it's like, I don't think my sense of empathy even properly developed until mid 20s. And it's like, even in my 40s, I'm like, now I'd like cry at everything. So it's recognizing that the teenagers are still a growing, evolving subset of human beings that are should be allowed to make mistakes. That was another big theme in the movie for sure.
So the cast was all teenagers for the most part? Oh wow, I didn't know that. But I also watched Jeopardy yesterday, and one girl was like 18, and I was like, what? Because she looked like she was 35. I'm just like, oh my God, that's a kid. But did you now when were they above age, so you didn't need to do scheduling shifts, or were they purely?
They were above age or emancipated, like for the purposes of shooting. Like Jalen Webb was 16 when we shot. So
Okay, and which character was that?
That is, sorry, I'm like, I need to think of my names now. That's James.
I know, I feel you, because it was probably when you were in edit. When did the edit end?
We locked. What did we lock? Almost like a Christmas and a half ago. So it's like, and then like, obviously there's all the post work that has to be done after that. But yeah, we've been kind of, and then this year's just been the festival run. So we've been sitting on this movie for a couple of years now. So
With
glad it
that,
hasn't aged dated itself.
yeah. Oh, well, I know that's scary, right? And the other thing is, I think that's a huge lesson to people who are who want to be filmmakers, is that's how long the process goes. And it's of course it's of course, like I was talking to my friend the other day about he's got two new books out, but they're in French. So he's doing publicity in France right now. He read my novel. He's one of my early readers of my novel. So he brought up Parker Posey in my novel, and I'm like, she's in the novel? He's like, oh my God, dude, yeah. There's a scene where she's referenced, and I'm like, oh wow. I'm like, and then he couldn't remember the name of his main character of the book that he was going to go promote. And he's just like, I can't remember his name right now. Oh my God, it's just like, because I think when you're so immersed, you're just like, when your whole life is 24/7 these characters, and then when it's like wrapped, and then when it's locked, the brain almost has to like, it's almost like learning a language and then forgetting the language. It's so weird.
Mark McKinney gave me a good anecdote about it, 'cause he's like, when we finished his scenes with as the Mormon bishop at the end, we were talking afterwards, and he's like, "Oh, do you mind just checking something out for me?" And then I was like, "Yeah, but can we wait until I get through?" He's like, "All right, that's right. You're in input, or sorry, you're in output mode right now. You got no time for input." I'm like, "That's exactly correct."
Yeah. So fascinating. Well, that I know he's from, that's the guy from Kids in the Hall, right? I'm not to not, yeah, I just wanted to make sure. So how do you does did he know your work? How do you present to him to get him on the set for it? Was it a day? Was he on for a day?
Yeah, he was there for a day, and he got a deleted scene, unfortunately, but it just, that's the
Mm.
way it is.
That must have been, oh my God, it's just when you know,
So hopefully
when you got the face of our generation's brilliance, and then you got to cut a scene that's just got to hurt, but you got to serve the
No, yeah.
story.
Well, hopefully if there's a physical release, there'll be some deleted scenes you can check out. But he, no, it was really interesting on this one. Like I said, like I kind of had to forego my genre circle, or like group, like not forego, but it's like all of my contacts are in the genre space. So to come outside of that and do this drama, I had a bit of, it's been a bit of like the genre people going, "Hey, what do you think you're doing?" And then the drama people going, "Hey, what do you think you're doing?" It's like, stay in your lane, both sides. But luckily, I think, without, being cocky or cavalier, but it's like, I think the script spoke for itself. It's had a lot of interesting things to say, so that when it started going out to agencies, they were like, "There's something here," and that made the conversations to the various talent agencies a lot easier. We had a wonderful casting director named Coco Kleppinger, who kind of took the reins and really believed in the movie. And she had a lot of great contacts that, for whatever reason, when it's like the only time I've had in my life where when the script goes to the agencies, that they're like, oh, we've got a lot of ideas who would fit this role, rather than like, what do you want from us? So
Oh, that's
it was a,
fascinating.
yeah. So it was a, it was a, it was a pleasant casting experience. It took a long while. Like we, I think I saw m like more than 1,000 teenagers for each of the kids. But you know, I think it shows on the screen that we found the right group.
Yeah, and there was just there was so much heart in their performances too in the final cut. They've seen it because it's been on the festival
Yes,
circuit.
they have.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've all
Were you
seen it.
around on when the first on their first watch?
I was around with Jeremy Ray Taylor, who plays Chris, when we went to see it for the first screening in Europe. But other than that, no, I haven't been traveling very much. So they've all seen it, but yeah, not on a big screen, I don't think. Like my last big theater screening was in Calgary at the Calgary Underground, where we got like that. I don't know what happened there. There was like lightning in the bottle. The room went berserk, and we got the audience award best picture. So I'm
I
hoping it
do.
finds its
I don't
audience,
think that's lightning in a bottle. I really
but
don't. I gotta tell you, usually I was only gonna watch the first act. So for the people listening, like we schedule, I got notification of what the film was, I think, on like Monday. And then we scheduled the interview yesterday. And when the interview was a go, then I'm like, oh, okay, I'm only gonna watch the first act. Because that's how I usually do it. I just want to get the vibe, and then I don't want to. I'll watch the rest of it later, and I couldn't stop watching it. I had to watch it to the end, and then it was so satisfying. Oh, my lower hand. I hate Zoom.
Don't know how
Not
my hand seems good.
sponsored by Zooms, but it's just
Exactly.
there. I know you're close to it. I know its release date is coming out. I did not expect to watch the whole movie yesterday, and I ended up carving out that hour and 45 minutes because I had to see these characters go. And that's just me in my house alone doing my thing.
I appreciate.
I hope when you think about it that you just there you do this yeah you probably got lightning in a bottle, but it's because of what you did. It's not just because of so
I appreciate that.
I want to give you a bro hug right now from Los Angeles, just because as far as capturing an 80s film, capturing Mormon is part of it because it's just the lead character's religion, but it's not the main focus. And it just it's the balance just blew my mind. It blew my mind.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad to hear it. So
Yeah.
we'll find out next Friday if everyone else agrees, that's for sure.
I really hope so. I'm gonna try to let as many people know as possible. Now, is it on streaming on October 24th? Is that
It's
the
coming
release
out.
date?
It's doing a mini theatrical that's across the states in Canada, as well as streaming platforms. I'm not sure which ones, unfortunately, but
Yeah.
it will be available on VOD as of Friday, October 24th.
That's so cool. The it, yeah, isn't it? People are like come up to me about the film, and they're like, "Hey, I just heard about your film. Where can I watch Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk?" I'm like, "I don't know."
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's still out there, but they don't, no one tells me, and I'm not actively looking because I'm working on other stuff.
You gotta hope and pray that the sales and distribution teams kind of know what they're doing better than I do, that's for sure. And I'll rely on their expertise to make sure that it gets to as many eyeballs as they can. All I can do is kind of just ask people kindly to try checking it out
Yeah,
wherever they can find it.
and what are you? Have you been working on something else?
I took a long break.
Good for you.
I wasn't ready on input. I wasn't ready on input mode yet. Still
Yeah,
not quite there. So,
yeah. Would you come back to a coming of age film again?
I have the next idea. I just haven't had the courage or energy to start working on it.
Yeah.
So,
And
yes,
when dealing with,
until
go ahead.
oh, I was just gonna say, until the motivation hits me proper, it's like forcing myself to do it just as it's not enjoyable for me. And also, like, the industry seems to be going through a pretty seismic shift right now. I'm kind of curious to just see where the dust settles before I put my full attention back into it.
what do you feel the cosmic shift is? Is it film versus like limited series, or is it something else?
It could just be viewers' tendencies. It could be streaming services now that ballooned during COVID, or now everyone's contracting. From an insider perspective, like, indies are selling less and less at the festivals, markets, places, and stuff. I'm very cognizant of not wasting my financier's time and money. It's there's a lot of things, and then how AI is going to fit into all of it. So a part of me is just wanting to see how things shake out. I don't like the idea of wasting people's time or money. So we'll see.
At the same time, we still got to create great art, you know. So we should be wasting people's money and time.
It's a unfortunately, it's a really expensive art form. That's all.
is. It is. The
So.
oh, I was gonna ask you. I was gonna go back to the teenagers. Because you really pulled out performances on them. Like I was impressed because I was bought into them being. Not fictional, but oh my God, they're like really going through this, which just great acting, great directing. And the I you let those kids go a lot. Is like, how do you direct a kid to kind of make them get what you want? So when you're working with a teenager, I mean, especially your lead's really got to carry that film. And did he even
Yeah.
understand he was carrying a film? Was that his first leading role?
Yeah, Max knew. I think this was his like proper like lead where he's carrying the whole thing. And I think he understood the assignment there. Like, he took it very seriously. He's a pro and he's just very talented. I mean, he was Will Robinson on Netflix for 4 or 5 seasons, whatever, however long that ran. But so he's got it in him that he knew how serious this needed to be for him. But we were blessed in the fact that my producer gave us a full week of rehearsals beforehand. I made sure to have many table reads. The actors all had rapports going in. Each of the cliques that were in the movie, I kind of made sure that they went off and kind of got to know each other beforehand. And it was kind of just the understanding. It's like, I'm not going to get into the weeds with your motivations, this and that. It's just come to the table with the characters built in your mind and prepared. And if we need to make tweaks on the day, we can. But I'm a very gentle director in the sense that I like them to come open, I come open too, and then we kind of get to play from there.
Magic, the magic of it all. His name is Rob Grant. The film is called This Too Shall Pass, coming out on October 24th. Rob, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Rob Grant on Drinks with Tony. Check out his new film coming out Friday, This Too Shall Pass. As you understand from our conversation, I highly recommend this film. I also highly recommend being productive during the holidays. What do you do when you're a writer and you got 2 weeks off during the holidays, or everything slows down in December? What I do is I work on a project to get myself ready for the next year. And that's me working on something in 2025 in December to kick off 2026 in a highly creative mode. What I'm also offering is for you, the listener and the reader, and whoever and however you're hitting this, I'm offering a 2 week screenplay outline workshop happening on the quietest time of year, unless you have a huge family and you're all united and peaceful, which I'm finding less and less of. If you are a huge family and you're all united and peaceful, well, bless your hearts and please do not join this workshop. But if you're like me and you're kind of an orphan and you want to get busy, so when the new year starts, this is for you. 10 days, we're going to work 5 days a week. It's going to be an hour to about 3 hours per day. It's going to be very specific assignments to get to the point where you got the 40 to 60 scene outline ready to go so you can start working on scene work January 1st. Go to drinkswithtony.com to register. That's drinkswithtony.com, the show you're listening to. That has a registration link to the 10-day screenplay outline workshop. This is where I feel like I get ahead of the game, and that's during the holiday season. And so I was like, hey, let's all get ahead of the game, because I'm going to be working on something too. So it's like I almost work with you, but I take my years of teaching screenwriting at UCLA Extension and really compress this to where we work together on a daily basis, and we just go. And at the end, we got the outline ready. DrinksWithTony.com. Hey, thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. We got some really great guests coming up. I'm not announcing it yet. I'm just urging you, keep listening. All right. Have a great week. You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. I don't mind. Sometimes I'm
she looks up, yeah.